Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey folks, Kaiser here. We've got a new initiative at SupChina that I want to tell you about because I suspect many of our listeners are just the sort of people we want to get involved. And it's a chance for you China nerds to parlay your arcane knowledge into a little income. We've launched a consulting and expertise marketplace called SupChina Direct. The goal is to connect the best China-focused talent with the companies and organizations who need support for their China-related projects and initiatives. Think of us as the Airbnb of highly qualified, deeply experienced China professionals. We've already built out a pretty decent network, a couple of hundred independent consultants and boutique consulting firms. We're really looking for people who know healthcare, consumer and retail, macroeconomics, and of course, technology. And if your business is looking for experts in those or pretty much any other fields, for anything from market entry to due diligence to digital marketing to supply chain sourcing, just get in touch. So whether you're a subject area specialist who wants to pitch new clients, or if you're looking for just the right specialist yourself, go to www.supchina.direct and sign up today. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is simply the best way to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to our original writing on the website. Sign up for SupChina Access and you get all that and much more with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China. From the latest on the trade war to the ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands or by some estimates well over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I am Kaiser Guo. I'm coming to you today from Washington, D.C., 30 years ago to this day, June 6, 1989, I was actually riding on a train between the city of Baicheng, which is in western Jilin on the Inner Mongolia border, and the city of Qichihar in Heilongjiang province. I was with my friends Ding Wu and Zhang Ju and my good friend Drew Sabo, who had been playing with all through college in a band. We were the first incarnation of the band Tang Dynasty and had for the past few weeks divided our time between writing and rehearsing new material for a movie we were supposed to be cast in and, of course, spending time on Tiananmen Guangchang, in Tiananmen Square, where the demonstrations were underway. We left Beijing on the morning of the 3rd of June, maybe about 14 hours before the first shooting started, and it wasn't until we arrived in the city of Qichihar in Heilongjiang province on the morning of June 7th that we actually knew that the stalemate that we had witnessed with we had seen people out near where the Third Ring Road is today, west of the Shangri-La Hotel, lying out in front of columns of APCs with the troops still looking very unsure of themselves. And we thought that it was a stalemate. So I was really shocked when on the morning of the 7th we arrived in Qichihar and found out there had been horrendous violence. So my guest today is someone I saw speaking in Tiananmen on a couple of occasions in May of 1989. I didn't know his name then, but I came to know who he was, along with much of the rest of the world, when he first took part in the televised student dialogue with Premier Li Peng. His name is Ur Kesdolet, but he's better known as Ur Kaixi. He was, of course, one of the founders of the Beijing Students Autonomous Federation. He was one of the instigators of the Tiananmen demonstrations. He helped to start that while he was a student at Beijing Normal University, a mere 21 years old. And he became, of course, one of the best-known student leaders of the Tiananmen protests of 89. And, of course, his student group was at the very core of that. We are delighted that, by chance, I was in D.C. When you were also in town for the Uyghur Congress that's going on right now, right? So I'm very excited to talk to you, especially so close to the 30th anniversary of the June 4th massacre, at a time when another issue, which is also close to your heart, the mass detention of Uyghurs in Xinjiang, is also on the minds of many people. So thank you for coming.
Thank you, Kaiser. I finally, I have been looking forward to having an opportunity to talk on your podcast
you
and
did.
Then to meet you too. And, yeah, I appreciate every possible channels to voice our, ideas.
Well, that's great. I'm glad we could do this.
And thank you.
Thank you. Also joining us is my very good friend, Nuri Turkel, who's been on the show a couple of times in the last year. I was having lunch with Nuri today when he mentioned that Uyghur Kaisi was in town. He reached out about a possible interview, and now here we are. So, Nuri, I asked you to join so that the two of you can talk about the situation in Xinjiang, of course, but I also hope that you're going to chime in and kind of act as a co-host here, yeah?
Thank you.
Yeah, ask questions about Uyghur Kaisi and his life. It's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Let me note that about 30 minutes before we started recording, I asked Twitter for some questions. I got some really good ones. I'm going to try to include some of those. So, but let me start off with Uyghur Kaisi here. What personally were your aims when you started off in the days just after Huiyabang's death on April 15th? What did you hope to accomplish?
The whole 80s, if you remember, China is in the direction of opening up and reform, and that's what we really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But the atmosphere in the campuses in Beijing at that time was somewhat, in 1989, was low, or despair, cynical. That's because throughout 80s, every single year, in the matter of fact, there were student demonstrations. We call it Xuechao, student wave, mm-hmm. student movement. Student waves. That's like the transliteration. And then all the student waves are aimed to do one thing, to express our dissatisfaction of the speed or of the reform, or also like the conservatism of the Communist Party, that it wouldn't bring the reform into the political arena, political domain. So I think 1980, let's also rewind a little bit to the end of 1986, the beginning of 1987, the mass student demonstration before 1989.
Sure.
That one was one of the biggest.
Yeah,
of the student waves. That
not just in Beijing, Shanghai as well.
It started from Anhui, in the matter of fact,
that's right,
and then came back to Beijing immediately. Anhui being the city of Chinese Technology University,
mm-hmm.
Where Fang Lizhi served as the vice president of the university.
The astrophysicist who some people call China Sakharov, right?
True. And then, but also he is more, I think his astrophysicist claim is in his field, but to us, to the students, to the Chinese intelligentsia in the whole 80s, he is like one of the founding father for Chinese democratization initiations.
Right.
Like he called for, he's the one who said, we need to import, we need to bring in Western technologies and investment, but we desperately need to bring in a new premier, which means we need a Western political system. We need ideas of democracy, basically.
Right.
So that movement was suppressed, and that movement, the suppression of that wave, have led to the cynicism, the depression in 1989 campuses around the country.
After those demonstrations that Huiyabang was sacked. He was removed as general secretary.
Exactly. Right. So Huiyabang, General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, have been believed for a long time as a sympathizer of the call for political reform. A lot of people at the, 80s is a time of a hopeful time in China. We have our despair, we also have our hope. And then Huiyabang is kind of a person that gives us that hope.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are other camps, there are other peoples like Hu Qiaomu,
if you remember.
Those people that represent the opposite. So when Huiyabang died, the atmosphere, it's his death, it's a spark drop into a gunpowder cake. So you can, it's a very long answer to your short question, what were we aiming? It's a consistent thing.
So you were aiming just for a commitment for deepening reforms, basically.
based on, yes, yes. If I have to answer the question in one sentence, that is that one question. But also, it's first of all, the express of that despair, the anger, all these things come in probably first before we can really think about, okay, now we have expressed our anger, but what do we really want? That question probably came in a couple of days later.
Ah, I see. Nuri, you were still in high school in 88, right?
No, 89. I was. I just started college.
Okay, so you were in Xi'an, right?
I was in Urumqi, taking my college prep courses, studying Chinese every day. This period is very interesting and important period that Urkesh was alluding earlier. In the early 90s, to the Uyghur people and other ethnic minorities, were kind of a period that their cultural rights were respected, social rights were respected, even though there was some level of political repression was widespread. But the Uyghurs experienced a cultural revival period, and that followed the Tiananmen Square pre-democracy movement, and the guy who's leading the movement happened to be one of the Uyghurs. So there was a public support. The university students pour into the streets of Urumqi.
You didn't really experience then a whole lot of racism then from your Han compatriots?
Not during that period. So if somebody asks, is there any period that the Chinese government can go back to, that they should look at that period and study? There was no single violence incident. People relatively happy and enjoying their daily lives. So as a first year college student, I learned about the movement in Beijing. I went to the People's Square in Urumqi, joined the protest.
Yes, 50 days of the Beijing student demonstration are the 50 days that in my, 21 year of life at that time, that I did not feel discrimination. I was born and raised in Beijing, and the discrimination is almost, I was like almost immune to that. But of course, growing up, and then I realized what I was immune and then probably neglected was discrimination. I mean, that will make you feel uncomfortable. And then Chinese, I think in general, also including today's like vibrant democracy, democratic Taiwan, they have this problem of understanding what is discrimination.
Right.
And then they think they don't have bad intention, but they just classify you as a different category.
Right.
That, to most Chinese people, is not discrimination. But then if you look into the textbook and then realize what is the discrimination, is you think there's another group of people that's different politically. Then that is discrimination.
But discrimination against Uyghurs in 1980s Beijing that I remember was vicious. Yes, I mean, it was a real sense that, I mean, they treated them very much like the Europeans often treat the Roma. They were considered sort of this sort of genetically criminal class. You were not, they were the people who would you know, carry knives.
Yeah. And
they would,
you need to know, okay, Uyghur people are the descendant of conqueror and warriors.
Sure.
At the same time, we're a descendant of merchants along the Silk Road. These two things that you described, we were people who carry knives, and we kind of resort to
nutcake.
when we feel like discriminated, we don't just just take it in. Sometimes yes. And then also we were a first group of people when Deng Xiaoping started this open and reform policy and said let the little group first, a small group of people get rich. And then Uyghur people say, that's right? We can do that. So the group of Uyghur people, this descendant of merchant who have never left this area of Xinjiang for 1,000 years, when Deng Xiaoping says, now you can do business, they found themselves in Guangdong, in
Central
Guangzhou.
Asia too.
Yes, they are they become the first group of people who import importers or...
Right.
Well, sometimes those imports are perhaps not 100% law-abiding. But then, that was the time. That was the time. And then you can see Uyghur merchants everywhere. They're selling merchants from You don't know how to get into the Chinese market. And then also, of course, you see the kebab sellers. That's on a different level of a merchant, but they spread to all different countries, all different cities. And there's another one. It's, foreign exchange.
Right.
We run the underground market of current financial market for a good period of time.
Yeah.
I guess that has get into some people's nerve and say, all of a sudden, you know, the Uyghur people, you are kind of cool. You dance, you sing, you make good shish kebab. Why don't you just stay in your remote corner? And why do you like all over the sudden spread all over to all the cities? And then that kind of triggered the discrimination mentality or sensation. Let me put it that way. Then of the 1 billion Chinese people, I think people listening to this would have a better reference if you haven't seen a group of people and all of a sudden they are
everywhere
and then you just don't get used to it. The discrimination emerged immediately.
Right. So did you grow up in Ganjiakou or in
Hepingli.
Oh, in Hepingli.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
I was born and raised in Beijing in Hepingli area. Hepingli is...
Yeah, I know Hepingli well. I mean, that's where all like the gold twins were and all that.
Yes, and then also the so-called Central Minority Publishing House.
Ah, I see. Is that what your parents worked for, exactly, the Central Minority Publishing House? I see. Okay.
Minzu出版社. Yes.
Okay. So that was actually a question that came in from Saul Thomas on Twitter. He wanted to know, because there were discussions in a book that Drew Gladney wrote about Muslims in China, said that we was wondering whether there were Uyghur-led protests in Beijing in the 1980s. Besides yours.
Yes. No. Thank you. Yes, there were a few demonstrations that's like not necessarily Uyghurs, but Muslim.
Uh-huh.
But on the issue of treatment to Muslims or discrimination wordings against Islamic faith followers. So, yes. So it's a specific theme. Protest, and then I think they even applied for a permit, and then so it was one of the legal demonstrations that took place during the 80s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's get back to the 1989 demonstrations. When you started marching the streets, you really cloaked yourselves in sort of banner of patriotism. You were calling for a deepening of commitment to reforms, but a lot of things changed. There was a major inflection point that a lot of people have talked about, which was the publication on April 26th of the People's Daily editorial, which labeled you an unrest, which would say that you
were rebel, right? Unrest, yeah. Yes. Patriotism was the word. It's more like it's so handy we just decide to pick it up.
Right.
Because it's always in the education, textbook and everything we were brought up in China. But
well, you were pretty safe. Look, I mean, you knew that Huabang died and they're not going to crack down on you if you're celebrating the death of somebody who, even though he's no longer general secretary, he's still on the Politburo Standing Committee. So he still has to have a state funeral.
He wasn't
you're
a standing
safe.
Committee member, but
Politburo. He was a standing committee member still.
Okay.
He was.
Yeah. But pretty soon we changed the tone from the patriotic movement into democracy movement.
Right.
In 1989, we were imitating Poland. Mm. That's like a very important reference that the world should know. What happened in 1989, a few things, like, first of all, solidarity movement in Poland. And then we saw it came along like step by step and very inspiring. The other thing is the new thinking that's introduced by Mikhail Gorbachev in Soviet Union is quite an exciting idea, and it certainly excited whole country, Soviet Union, I mean. We used the word patriotism, but actually at that time we were not under any attack from a foreign aggression.
Right.
So the transliteration of the word patriotism back into Chinese is 爱国主义.
Right. It's love of country.
Love of country, yes. So a love of country is something we just claim, and then we say, we are doing this in the love of our country. we are pushing China toward democracy in the love of our country. And then the word love of country is so coincident with patriotism, we just picked it up, used it. But for not for a long time, though. Pretty soon we decided
to start talking naturally, about democracy.
Naturally emerge into calling ourselves a democracy movement. And people who supported us also demanded us to add the slogan of anti-corruption.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So that did not come indigenously from the students themselves.
No.
So who are these people then who were supporting you? You're talking about leading intellectuals.
The intellectuals came into the scene a little later. It was just students at the beginning. We were looking for guidance. We were looking for our teachers to come in, but not until, I think, a week later, maybe 10 days later, Liu Xiaobo flew back from United States to Beijing to join this movement. He found me the night he arrived in Beijing. We were looking for, and then, of course, Liu Xiaobo carries a very special meaning to all the students at that time. Right. He was also one of the spiritual mentor for the whole 80s generation. So, yes, we welcomed him. But in the very beginning, until Liu Xiaobo showed up, until later on, the movement was very much a student-led indigenous movement.
So then who was it pushing this idea of including corruption in your agenda?
No. We took quite a few march already.
Right.
So on the street, people would just, people would express their support. But they also would ask, include this anti-corruption. You guys should include this anti-fan-guan-dao. How to translate that?
Yeah, Guandao, I don't know how to. Yeah. So on the probably it was the 18th or the 19th of April, the first major march from the campuses down to the square went right by where I lived at the time, which was in Xisi. I went out to the Hutong Kou, to the mouth of the Hutong, which is on Xisi Nandajie, or Xisi Beidajie, as they're coming down towards Xidan, and they were going to cut over on Changjie. And they marched right past me, and there were several schools represented, and I watched this happen. And they all carried a twine, that kind of pink-colored plastic twine you use to wrap packages in the old, stores that you'd buy things in China. And so it was circling the parade route. People on the edges of the parade would carry this. We were holding this up, and they were excluding deliberately people. I said, could I join the march? No, they said no. I said, well, I just recently graduated from university. No, they said no. This is only students, only from these schools.
Yeah.
When did you decide to open it up to include other segments of society?
Not too long, because the biggest, the first intercity demonstration took place on the night of April 21st. And before that, there were demonstrations, but from different universities was segmented. But April 21st is a very important day of the student movement. And that day, we got organized. We got the whole school, inter-school Beijing Coalition for the Students' Union was formed.
Right.
I was the founder of this thing. I led the first intercity major demonstration. At that time, we were still pretty much insisting that this should remain as a pure student movement. The reason for that is we were so nervous. We were so worried that the Chinese government is going to slander, as they usually always do when there is a student movement, when there is a very pure motivated movement. They will always say there is a small group of criminal who actually behind the scene,
right,
who get involved into the crowd and then lead the crowd into vandalism or this and that. That's the Chinese government's typical propaganda line. So we were trying to avoid that. We were naive, of course. We thought if we hold a string to exclude other people who wants to join us, we can prevent Chinese government from doing just that. They will do that anyway, But then, right after you were also mentioning April 26th editorial,
right,
by People's Daily, I think what happened is, I'm convinced of that, that the April 21st major demonstration went in the evening. We went to Tiananmen Square. We occupied Tiananmen Square. We have successfully demonstrated this enormous power and then our ability to get organized. And that
spooked them.
Exactly. That's the right word. Yeah. And then Deng Xiaoping was so spooked. He says, I don't mind killing them. I don't mind killing the students. I learned much later on that he said it in such early stage. But it's so totally convincing, because if you read the April 26th editorial, then you find with between the line, the tone of the editorial is very much killing sensation. So yes. But then we decided.
There,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. We decided to. Responded with a bigger, stronger rebuke. So we had this April 27th major demonstration, one of the best, most powerful, most well-organized, most attended a demonstration of the 1989 student movement.
This is exactly what my timeline has always been. There was the 21st organized march really spooked them. I was there for that.
Yeah.
Then on
27th.
You know, but Zhao Ziyang left China. He went to North Korea on the 24th or the 25th.
Something like
he
that.
He was gone during that. Those it must have been
kind of
crucial meetings.
Thing, yeah.
Terrible timing for him.
The Communist Party are incapable of changing, making a last minute change.
That's they're not flexible in that
they're
way.
No, right. They're not. So the April 27th demonstration, we took the Beijing Ring Road. The movement, I was the general commander of that demonstration, I remember. Students come from far, like, say, Tsinghua University or Beijing University. They are in the outskirts, much further away from the center.
Right.
Where my university, Beijing Normal University, is pretty much in the center of the city, right up between second ring and third ring.
Right.
So university students from the university district will come into my school first, and then we march out from there. The students from Beijing Daxue, from Beida, from Tsinghua, they have to get up like 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. They start to march out of their school. We, in the leisure, that we march out on the 9 o'clock, and then we came back with a circle the ring road.
Right, the second ring at the time.
Second ring, yes.
So it was like, you know, Xi Zhiming, Fuchengmen, and
we circled that, we came home. Yeah. I remember it was around 10 p.m. to Beijing Normal University, and then the Beijing University students have to take another 2-3 hours back to theirs. What I was trying to say is that when we took the ring road, I mean, 100,000 students took the ring road. It's a long, long line of students. What's more exciting is the people standing by on the two sides of the ring road, that's Beijingers. Their support is the one who gave us all the confidence. It has to be 500,000 people there day.
I watched that. I was on the west side.
From that day on, we would never exclude anyone who wants to join us.
So it really was the 27th March that was the turning point.
In my recollection, yes.
That's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Let me ask you this question. Do you, when the Uyghurs took to the streets to support the students, they did
you mean
it
back in from
back
Urumqi.
1989. Yes, in Urumqi.
In Urumqi, yeah.
Yeah, I was. I had the privilege to be part of that. So the thinking is that if this is successful, we will have a better life.
Yes.
So with that mindset, did you guys ever talk about the future political system for China, with respect to how non-Han Chinese minority people would be treated or fit in the system?
We did talk about it, discuss among the students, but then the real immediate aim for the students, the slogan we put forward is dialogue. So, you know, if the dialogue occurs, subjects of the dialogue would definitely include like ethnic issues. But then the 1989 student movement is to first bring the government not bring them down, but bring them lower to the level they have to sit equal with us. And then dialogue also means we want to have something to say. We want our voice to be heard. We want to take part in. So if that happens, and then the more specific aim of the 1989 student movement is to preserve the autonomous students, the Federation of Autonomous Student Unions as a legal entity, to make that the
official representative of the student interest, right?
Not the special students, but more of a political independent force. We want the student, the federation, to become China's solidarity. So that's the idea. We want that to act before a real opposition or political party to emerge. We want this federation to act just at that role.
I see.
So
to assume the same role that dock workers in,
exactly,
in Gdansk
exactly.
had.
But then Solidarity really later on become a political party.
Right.
At the beginning, it was just a worker union. So we thought, okay, with students' union can also play a similar role. And then one day there will be political parties, but we want to be the one to make that happen.
I mean, I think there were some precursors for this already. You could sort of see on April 12th, there was that petition that Wang Dan actually signed saying we want a special democratic zone in Haidianqu. Right?
Yeah. So the 1989 student movement is definitely a democracy movement. We have... this political goal, very clear goal in our mind. We want to, and then the slogan we put forward, including, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of press, and freedom of assembly. These are very political goals, but we were also thinking on the strategy level that, okay, let's just demand for dialogue. And then, because if that dialogue ever occurs, this is going to set a new page for Chinese life, that people will start to have a say. And then with that dialogue happening, it will consequently preserve the Federation of Beijing Autonomous Student Union as a legal entity to survive.
I see.
And then it will basically... give birth to Chinese multi-party system.
I'm curious whether you were conscious at all of the potency of the sort of symbolic weaponry that you guys had at your disposal. I mean, there is a long history, a very proud history of student participation in intellectual political life that goes back to the Wu Si Yundong and even before. It goes back to 1898. It goes back to 1895, really. And there's sort of a way to do it. There's a theater that you were performing that you did very well, I would say, that the students knew that would tug at the heartstrings of ordinary Beijingers who knew their history. You had also available to you things like a bunch of nice round anniversary dates that you could play on. Were you aware of the potency of this?
We are aware, but you know, it wasn't planned. We didn't plan Hui Yaobang's death, of course.
No, of course not, right. But you were already preparing for a big May 4th demonstration.
Not before Hui Yaobang's death.
I've read many places that there
probably,
was there were plans,
but then those plans were like in a very, very seeding period, but phases. And but of course, when the movement started, we did manage to organize a few very successful demonstrations already, especially after April 27th, major success. We were looking 1 week away from the 70th anniversary of May 4th movement. Right. And then we, not just the Chinese government take a propaganda to really legitimized the 1919's May 4th movement as one of the pioneer movement for Chinese modernization.
You were going to contest that.
We the students, especially again, taking the same steps on the same street in Beijing. And then also May 4th movement, in May 4th movement, Beijing Normal University, Beijing University were all major players.
Right.
So we have this strong sensation of we are the true legacy of May 4th movement.
Right.
At that time, we all felt very strongly. We still felt
with
like,
good reason. With
oh, good, I guess, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. And no, then, I mean, of course.
You, and then for to have a major demonstration to commemorate, to celebrate May 4th spirit seems to be, you know,
natural.
Natural. It wasn't even a debate, but it's That's of right. course going to happen.
Right.
So whatever happened before May 4th, on that day, we will take the street. And then we did. And then in other, a little different from the April 27th march, we decide to go to Tiananmen. The April 27th, we avoided Tiananmen. We took the Ring Road. But in, on the May 4th, we made a left turn in Xidan,
right.
where then, you know, that lead to the Eternal Peace Avenue, Chang'anjie. Later on became a killing field. But
that demonstration, we had a million people in the square.
I don't know how many people, but what my count is at least 500,000 because...
Yeah. I mean, it was full. The square was full.
Then it has to be 1 million.
Yeah, that, I was there on the May 4th.
And then I gave a speech.
I saw you give a speech.
I gave a speech to a million people then, I guess.
Let me ask you something about... Because sitting here and talking to you, it's pretty obvious... To me, where sort of the sources of your charisma are. You have. How young
I
were you?
Don't
when,
know
when,
that.
when you were young, did you know that you were destined for to do this? Were you a revolutionary at heart? Were you somebody who had leadership aspirations? Were you somebody who was an organizer among the kids in your neighborhood, in your own family? What were you like when you were young?
You know, Kaiser. Yes, but before the anniversary, somebody else also asked me similar questions. And then I, to be very honest with you, I got a little, like, puzzled with this question. Because then I realized all these questions are in a relative term. You know, are you a revolutionary in compare with other people? There's relativity
there.
There's
a type, though. There's a type. And, you know that you are.
Then
I know that I'm not.
I myself wouldn't know what my type was at that time. I was just, I did the thing that I feel natural to.
Okay. This is one of the questions that I always get. He was 21-year-old young student. And he is a minority living in Beijing growing up. And then whenever I mention that I have a close friendship with Workesh, like, do you know what was the process like him becoming a leader of this movement? Like, especially the young kids today grow up in the Western societies, wanted to be like him. And find out, was he prepared for this? Is that because of the family background? Is that because of the education? Because of his street creed?
Because he's being an outsider.
Because of all
how,
of
what
the
What was
above.
The process like that you...
No, my parents... No, the way my parents... I'm sure the way my parents brought me up has something to do with it. It has to be.
Right.
It's not like, okay, we're not going to prepare you as a revolutionary when
of
you're 21.
Not.
It's not like that. It's like you have to stand up when someone else is getting bullied. You have to take it as yourself being bullied. You have to stand up for other people. Things like this, you don't find in Chinese, Han Chinese education. In a matter of fact, I realize... I'm
not maybe that, but you find it in the novels. You know, the heroes are always Jian Yi Yongwei. You know, you read Shui Hu Zhuan or you read, you know, San Guo Yan Yi. There are heroes like that.
Yeah, your parents don't teach you to follow those knight stories. The knight stories is for teenager rebellious time period, basically. Both school and home education in Chinese society do not teach you things like that. Then, you know, but my parents and we in our culture, it's natural. So what happened, I think in the April 17th, when the night, nobody else took the stage in the campus of Beijing University. Somebody put a poster in Beijing Normal University and said, let's have a gathering tonight, 9 o'clock. And I showed up at around 10:30, but, you know, people were there waiting for someone to step up, but nobody did. It just, and everybody in the crowd was cursing, basically. You know, you can imagine for 21-year-old college students what they can curse, you know. What kind of, yes, we can imagine that. But then I'm in the crowd. I was, you know, I want to curse too. I want to say you, blah, 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 blah. But then And then I realized that if I do that, I'm cursing myself. And in our culture, the way I was brought up, including the, you know, what I'm saying, my culture, my parents' education, and everything else that has accumulated all its way till that day, that I just feel in that moment that this is my moment. I need to do that. I have to do that. It's not like, oh, I have been waiting. No, it's like it's an instinctual thing. You just have to do it.
You can remember that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because that moment, I reflect back, in that moment changed my life. Yeah, from that moment on, I just, you know, I remember in the crowd, because there's no light. There's street light, but there's no like a light for the gathering. There's no loudspeakers, and then just about 1,000 students in Beijing Normal University gather around this monument. Also a monument to commemorate a student movement decades ago. And then they're shouting, and again they're cursing, and I remember I just couldn't stand it, and somebody needs to be there. Okay, it may as well just be me. So, and then I remember I yelled, "Rang Kai."
Mm-hmm.
Yield.
Yeah, rang kai means get out of the way, right?
Oh, yield, yeah. Or just give me way, yeah.
Make way.
Immediately, a pass was emerged between me and the stage. It wasn't really a stage, it's the base of the monument. When I say rang kai, people like get apart and like, you know.
Okay. Now I look at you and I can imagine that. I mean, now you can yet Zhang Fei. I mean, you've got like, what did Jason call it? Dad strength. Right?
Would you do it again? In light of all the sacrifice you made, you have not seen your parents 30 years. I heard that the last time that you saw your mother was during Tiananmen Square pro democracy movement in Beijing.
Okay, would I do it again? If you ask me, do I regret what I did? The answer is no. I mean, I don't regret. That I can answer without any hesitation. But would I do it again? I have to say I don't know.
Would you do it differently?
I'm sure if there's a, you know.
Like, you now okay. You know a lot
without
of things.
Knowing there is no time machine, right?
Of course
not. We're
right.
Talking about. So if you put yourself, if you know you cannot avoid it, but you are going, sending back to fine tune here and there, maybe. But I would say 1989 student movement was a pretty damn good, well organized student movement.
Yeah.
And then all the decisions we made were very cautious and very well deliberated. And then.
Well, I mean, you've come in for a lot of criticism, even from fairly moderate people, for the way you conducted the dialogue that you finally ended up getting with Premier Li Peng. Is there anything you would change about that?
No. First of all, my role at that time dictated me to do, to say those things.
To be the bad cop, or to be the heavy, or to be the
first
the
of all, we were quite polite. We were firm. On mm-hmm. our ground, but we were quite polite. So we weren't like trying to provoke or anything, but then we were the representative of hunger strikers in the room. Finally, because of this hunger strike, because thousands of students had hunger strike, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, yes, more than hundreds, if not millions of people who supported this student movement, we wouldn't have that meeting. So my role being in that room is not just being me. I was the representative of people's will at that time. I have no choice but to stand firm for people.
But, you know, the things that you did, like scolding them for being late or...
That's because Li Peng came in and first sentence he started and says, "I'm sorry, I'm late for 20 minutes
right.
because you have made Beijing a such a chaos. It become an anarchy." And, you know, it wasn't a dialogue. We were waiting for a dialogue, but it was a condescending lecturing. And then that we... thousands of students, hunger strikers, and hundreds of thousands or millions of people who took the street at that time cannot tolerate. And then I am just expressing that voice.
So you were actually in hospital the night of June 3rd. So you missed out on a thing. But do you think that you lost control, that the Autonomous Student Union lost control of the movement in any way? Do you feel like that, you know, if you had, I know that I've heard this from a lot of people who took part in it, who said, for example, if the Beijing students had been there to call the shots, if everyone had left as they did on the night of the 3rd, they could have gone home and pocketed a lot of gains. They would have thought that there would still be a possibility that Zhao wouldn't have lost his position as Secretary General, and that.
Well, all these arguments are based on one fact, that they know what happened later.
Right, and you didn't know, you couldn't.
Yeah, the decision we made at that time, the debate we had, stay or leave. There are different factors contributing to different decisions, but none of those decisions were being informed that there are going to be a massacre a couple of days later.
Right.
So the criticism, I understand, and when people see massacres in their TV sets, in their living rooms, the ache in their heart must be unbearable.
Yeah,
I was in Beijing, so I wouldn't. But after my exile in the first few years, when people talk to me about that time, I can still feel their ache in their heart. So that ache, they need some kind of let out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were hoping the biggest let out would be the best let out would be, you know, the collapse of the Chinese Communist regime. That would be the best. And then they were hoping. So they were looking for all kind of excuses. Why didn't you leave earlier? Why couldn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And it's an understandable sensation when the whole world were in some kind of shock, traumatic experience when government start to kill their young peaceful protesters. They basically gave a whole world a traumatic experience.
Let's talk about now your years in exile. So you managed to leave China after 1989. You were put on this most wanted list by, I think, June 7th or so. And I don't know how much you want to go into the details of how you managed to leave, but you found your way to Paris.
Well, first of all, not CIA.
Okay.
Some people say that. And then also, I managed to get to Hong Kong. At that time, Hong Kong was one city that gave us the most support. I would even say 1989 student movement took place in Beijing as the main stage. But Hong Kong is definitely one of the most important stage too. There were student demonstrations in Shanghai and other cities, but Hong Kong is very much in it.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't live under communist regime, Chinese ruling at that time. The alliance was formed, Alliance to Support Beijing Patriotic Student Movement, the very long name. But when I finally managed to leave Beijing, get to the border city, I managed to contact them. Then they send in people to got me out.
So you're easily one of the most recognizable of the protesters, of the student leaders.
Yeah,
for sure.
So whenever I go, it wasn't easy, but amazingly, yes, wherever I go, I got recognized. So right. Make it kind of more difficult. The live broadcast of my meeting with Li Peng made that happen.
Right.
And then the more down south I go to when I reach, Hong Kong, information disseminated in from Hong Kong to the southern cities also have a lot of my picture on it.
Right.
So I got recognized all the time. But then, whenever I got recognized, those who did recognize me always provided shelter or provided help.
Mm.
And with the help of Hong Kong people and Chinese people, I managed to escape. Another thing is like the British have left some good things for Hong Kong, but they also left one pretty bad tabloid culture. So one of the tabloids in Hong Kong said, like, I managed to get to the south of China because my father was a general who can mobilize a air force and air force plane, and who I ride all the way from Lanzhou to south. I mean, you can't.
Which part of that isn't true?
Well, okay, which part of that isn't true? Okay, let's focus in one thing. Imagine an Uyghur become a general who can mobilize an airplane.
Right,
that part is like one of the most stretched imagination that I have to applaud to that person, whoever that is, wrote up this report in the office of this tabloid magazine. Yeah,
that's hysterical. Oh my god. Years in exile. So you were in Paris for a couple of years. You made your way to California. You were there. I know that Nuri, you actually have talked about how Orkesh helped you in your early career.
Yeah, we had mutual friends back home. That's how we got to know each other. So I moved to California from where I was studying up in Northwest, and we were roommates for a period of time. And that was, as I recall, the most difficult time that I had in my early period in the United States. So my good friend helped me to find job, even asked one of his friends to loan me a car so I can work and make some money and get my own car. So we, as a friend, he provided me much needed support in addition to true friendship.
Yeah. But it was okay. Yeah.
It's nice to talk about, you know.
The diaspora community comes in for a lot of criticism, and, you know, it's not surprising that there's a lot of
diaspora society,
diaspora, especially Uyghur. The dissidents and
dissidents. Society,
I mean, not the diaspora Uyghur community, but the Chinese dissidents. After Liu Si, there was, I mean, immediately they started falling to fighting almost right away. There were gigantic divisions and cleavages, and I saw this happening with sort of in horror. Mm. Even just I was on the campus of the University of Arizona, and Fan Li Zhi was there actually, in the building right next to me, and we used to see each other all the time. We talked, and it was quite clear there were factions of students that were very opposed to him. There were factions of, it was just crazy.
I guess, but then it's. You know, we are a group of dissidents who are forced into exile and then carry the responsibility of the whole world in overthrowing the one of the most powerful totalitarian regime. That's the pretext of all the criticism and what went on among the dissident societies. The whole world were in shock, and we have been given a responsibility. There's no way we can carry. We could not, we challenged and then we lost that challenge in Beijing. How could we possibly organize to overthrow that government who already opened their its fire to us from Paris? That's
understandable. But what about what caused the disunity, though?
That's what I'm saying. You know, there is no battlefield. If there is no battlefield,
they'll automatically turn on one another.
No, there's actually, we don't know which direction to turn on to begin with.
I see. That's fair enough. Yeah. So these days, how much of your attention are you focusing on the crisis in Xinjiang?
These days, I think I'm paying more and more
attention to
spending it. Attention is always there. That's not the right word.
Right.
Spending more and more of my energy and time on the issue from the July 5th incident
in 2009.
Right. Yes. Today I was in this Uyghur conference, and then my friends introduced me. This is Orkesh. His name Orkesh is known to all Uyghurs, and his Chinese name Orkesh is known to all Chinese. It's a good introduction, but then I also use that in the past and say, you know, I'm probably to discuss my role with my Uyghur friends. I say, you know, I can probably do more for Uyghur as Orkesh than as Orkesh.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And then in the Uyghur movement, there are, you know, a lot of distinguished fellows. They're making their efforts, and then they have always been an Uyghurs movement, and they should, you know, carry the flag. Nuri here is one of the pioneer, one of the champion.
Yes.
And then I, on the other hand, have always been a Chinese democracy activist. I started from Tiananmen Square, and then all these years in exile, I believe that Chinese democracy is the ultimate answer for Uyghur people in future. But of course, the history can evolve in different direction. But I believe democracy should be the answer for Uyghur people. And then it's good in the Chinese democracy movement to have an Uyghur in there.
Yes. And
in the last 10 years, since 2009, I have this personal feeling urge to get more directly involved. My direct involvement is more just like writing articles and talking about when I'm with Chinese dissidents group, when I'm with the overseas democracy movement, I often insisting on discussing about Uyghurs, Tibet, you know, ethnic issues, and then I often lead that discussion. So in that sense, I'm still in Chinese democracy movement and then having my fight for Uyghur.
And how is that going? How is the response among Chinese democracy, Han Chinese democracy activists? Are they making common cause? Do they sympathize deeply
Okay, let's say, first of all, Chinese democracy movement, overseas Chinese democracy movement, is not a huge body of people. Let's say there are 500. That's 500 people.
Sure.
It's not really. Let's just for the conversation's sake, if there are 500 people overseas Chinese democracy movement, I think a good half of them will be 100% supporting of the Uyghur cause and then totally understanding for Uyghurs and Tibetans, mm-hmm. A demand for independence. That word is the most,
center
of the of this debate, right? So let's not go around that. And then I discussed this topic with my Uyghur friend and my Chinese friend. When I discussed this topic with my Uyghur friend, I start to say I'm not a nationalist. I am not a separatist. I'm a democracy activist. I'm a libertarian. Because of that, today, I would 100% support any effort to fight for democracy and independence. Because independence will guarantee, if we can manage to get independence today from communist China, it's definitely beneficial for Uyghur people's liberty. I'm a libertarian, so that dictates my decision, my choices. But when I talk to... So I will say that, but then I'll also say I'm not a separatist. I discussed this with my Uyghur friend.
I'm not sure what the distinction is. If you support independence, but you're not a separatist.
I welcome independence because I am a libertarian.
I see.
So the ultimate goal of my effort is freedom.
Liberty, right.
It's freedom. But if you claim yourself a separatist, that means you will fight for independence at all costs and in all conditions.
So that means that even if you're a separatist, you would support, for example, radical Islamic sect that would lead...
Military dictator who right. can... those That kind of independence I'm not in.
I see.
Yeah. So, but when I talk to my fellow Chinese dissidents, my tone is like, okay, you guys totally need to know Uyghur people have the right to fight for their independence. If we call ourselves democracy activists, we should 100% unconditionally welcome the major principle of democracy, which is self-determination. So I think I am in a good position to talk to both Uyghur, my fellow Uyghurs, and my fellow Chinese democracy activist groups.
One common question that people always ask, why the governments are not taking action. And one of the main reasons...
Which government?
Muslim governments.
Muslim governments, Western governments, other than the United States. The one possible answer is that the Uyghurs are not well known. And then the follow-up question is like, okay, if we had a figures like Urkesh Devlet leading the movement in the last 20-some years, we would have been in a different place. We would have been able to build grassroots movements. People have been saying this. What is your thoughts on that? Do you think that is just you would have been much more effective
That's not true. My role in the Uyghur movement will not be much different from our beloved Erkin Esa Pendi. You know, he couldn't. The Uyghur movement has always had leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, the leaders beloved by Uyghur people, and then we would have follow his leadership, but to have. The very fact Uyghur movement is not...
But they're not a celebrity as you are, though. That's a different story.
Well, Rabia Kadir was a celebrity.
Exactly. Rabia is a celebrity. And
this was... Like, the point is
no,
that...
No, I'm saying that
started
is
in the 90s I know, and 2000...
I understand the argument.
Yeah, before Rabia Kadir
but
was
But I disagree
released.
With it.
Yeah.
The real reason Uyghur movement has not been in the map, there are many, many factors to contribute to that. Number one, unfortunately, Uyghur people are in Islamic phase. Let's look at this with all honesty.
Sure.
Today's world...
Islamophobia.
Today's world are not that honest. Today's world is not that courageous. We don't live in a perfect world, and then the Western world just, you know, you find much more convenient to neglect Uyghurs movement. They have for a long time when Chinese regime calling their policy in Xinjiang part of the anti-terrorism. The suppression of the Chinese government to Uyghur people have been going on for how long? We'll see, easily decades, right? Only in the last 2 years, when it come to this level, that the world can no longer, that's the key word, no longer turn their blind eyes. Well, they're still trying.
So they acquiesced in this idea.
But
that,
what
that
I'm saying is the world tried really hard to turn a blind eye in a long time. Even if there were a celebrity leader, and how about Tibetan? They have a very well-known celebrity leader, right? And you think... Look at that. Where did the Tibetan movement go? They, you know, it's famous. It's a famous movement. But Tibetan people today under the same kind of suppression that we do.
Yeah.
Tibetans didn't manage to gain any inch of independence.
Did you expect at all that it will get this bad in China for the Uyghur people? Did you ever thought that we will see this modern-day concentration camp situation?
I have to admit, our naivete 30 years ago as a student in Beijing perhaps stayed in us until very recent days. No,
what about after July 5th? Did you start to think, you know, this is going to get much worse now?
Yes. It was still a Communist Party, Chinese regime seems to always be able to surprise us. No matter how much we think they're capable of doing, they can always surprise us with more. This is the government, this is the regime the world is facing. So let me also take this opportunity to extend it to the next sentence. If the world sank... You know, the Chinese regime, they're suppressed. They can capable of massacre their peaceful demonstrators 30 years ago. They can suppress their dissent in China. They can do this, do that. And then they can capable of gathering over a million people in concentration camp. And then if we say today, they can probably launch another campaign against the whole world. And then the world probably need to shake off that naivete we had and then start to exercise its imagination.
Well, my imagination doesn't quite stretch that far at this point yet, but it certainly has been tested recently by some of the horrors that we've witnessed. Why has President Trump stayed silent so far. We've heard remarks now from Pompeo, from Mike Pence, from others in the administration.
I don't think he got it.
Yeah?
Look at the I mean, he got something. He's a businessman, right? He saw an image like, okay, I talk about this. Let me on your show name and talk about this again. The China policy, over-complimenting China policy, started from Dr. Henry Kissinger. He went to Beijing in the early 70s, and he basically architected this whole China policy. And then he repeatedly insists that the China policy was for America's national interest. And of course, I mean, good thing he cleared that out. I mean, there is no moral foundation for being nice to a government a totalitarian regime. But that national interest has long expired. The national interest is forming an alliance, form a united front together with China
against the Soviet Union
during the Cold War era. And then, you know, Cold War ended, and the Chinese government become the government who suppresses, who massacres peaceful demonstrators. Did that China policy then alter? No. It continued until today, and then they decide to find new names. They call it engagement. Mm-hmm. I call it appeasement. And let me say this. Dr. Henry Kissinger himself became the most welcome guest by Beijing. He brokering American companies to go to China to do business with favored access. And for each company he brokerage, he gets a minimum of $1 million fee. Dr. Henry Kissinger, he lives 90-some years, almost 100 years now. I
can't attest the veracity of how much he's paid for the deal.
He is fabulously rich. What's wrong with this picture? Is there anything wrong of this picture? I mean, if I want to ask American people to say, you know, hey, this key architect of this policy is becoming very rich from one of the party that he brokerage. I think, you know, the businessman president, being a businessman himself, saw something wrong. But he's a businessman. That means if he come up with a new policy, it will also be interest-centric. And then the real lesson is not that policy was wrong, we need to adopt a new one. The real lesson here should be interest-centric policy is wrong. It should be value-centric policy. And the United States, if today form a value-centric China policy, its ally will have to follow. And today, against China, if United States does not have its ally gather to support, to stand behind U.S., it won't pull out. China is way too strong, and then it's a little too late.
What is your sense after being after testifying in Congress early this week and attending a series of meetings with legislators and thought leaders and activists? What do you think is the a possibility? Or do you think that the U.S. government and U.S. Congress will address China democracy and internment of Uyghurs differently?
I hope so.
After all those events and public statement, you were pretty provocative during your testimony. you called out the U.S. government for betraying the students.
And democracy, most importantly.
And it was pretty strong. And I watched the whole thing. None of the members of Congress presiding in the hearing were annoyed with your statement.
I think, yeah, thank you for saying, I mean, I think the sentiment in the Congress or in Washington, D.C. is very much in unity. But for them to take a step and acknowledge to say, wow, we made such a big mistake. We were so embarrassed. Now we have to do something drastic to change. It probably take a little more than wisdom. It will take humility. It will take a much more healthier attitude, and it will take courage. Those things I'm not sure.
What kind of change do you foresee? Is that like a more of a anti-China?
No, not anti-China. Anti-Chinese 200 family. Treat the 200 families as criminal groups. And I also said in the hearing, The United States will be much better off when forming the new China policy to consult criminologists rather than consult international relation experts. Because if you treat Chinese regime as what they really are, a group of criminals, and then they are certainly not ideology, they are not communists, they are not nationalists. Calling them fascist is even giving them too much credit. They are a group of bandits who stole the position of ruling.
I think that you can now, today, in light of things like the Uyghur atrocity, to make these sorts of sweeping moral indictments about the Chinese Communist Party is a little easier than it would have been, say, 12 years ago.
It wasn't just an indictment. It was a policy suggestion.
Okay, but you know, it's built on sort of a set of moral...
simple fact.
Whoa, okay.
It's your facts, simple
not
fact.
My facts, not my facts. But anyway, I want to ask you a little bit about your time in Taiwan, because, you've been there now for my gosh, since the late
23 90s, years.
23 years.
Longer than any other country that I have lived, including my home country.
My God. You've gotten quite involved in politics in Taiwan. My understanding is that you support the Pan Greens. Right?
No, that's not a correct statement.
Okay.
These days, work closely with Pan Green because they are the one group doesn't mind talking about Beijing, talking about Communist Party. When I first arrived in Taiwan, was 1990. I didn't move to Taiwan back then, but that was my first visit. It was the blue camp who was this Greater China sentiment who welcomed me much more, where at that time the green camp is more like Taiwan independence, China is China, we don't care, that kind of idea. But over the 29 years since 1990, I think the Pan Green has come to the point that they realize they are not just Taiwan Independence Party, they are Democracy Progressive Party. That's the name of the party. So the democratic value is something that will lead this party and their supporters to a long, long run in this country. But where the Pan Blue very, very unfortunately took a very wrong turn. Back in the early 90s, they were like a Greater China sentiment. But they also in an anti-communist stage. And they felt like the democracy is not their vocabulary. It's not their, because they were authoritarian regime, and then Green Camp was the challenger.
Sure.
And then it has become the political vocabulary of the Green Camp.
And it was visited on, it was forced on the poor
blues. I really hoped that Blue Camp can also embrace to say, you know what, we are democratic too. And because they really are. In a democratic system, it's a democratic party, and then they welcome democracy too.
So but when do you mark this shift beginning, when they stopped caring so much about the Greater China issues and became sort of throwing themselves their fate in with the Chinese Communist Party? Do you think this was obviously not in the 96 crisis? It was much later. Ma Ying-jeou's tenure, was it?
Even before that, I think Ma Ying-jeou, he himself is a little different from the rest of his party.
Sure,
he believed in he was a sympathizer of the Chinese democracy movement.
Yes,
he took part in every June 4th commemoration event until he became president. I think he has a true heart for the idea of freedom, democracy. The KMT later on, the majority of them felt to preserve their position, they have to ally with Beijing for economy reason, I guess. For whatever reason, that was a very, very, for lack of better word, stupid decision. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, you've made a couple of runs for the Legislative Yuan in
just
your
one,
time.
Just
one run? Okay.
Yes.
Do you think that your stature as a prominent dissident has helped you in your political life in Taiwan, or has it hurt you more?
Both. Well, first of all, if I wasn't a prominent Chinese dissident,
no one would know
they
who
probably
you are.
Would, yeah, no one would know me, and they probably wouldn't come to consult me about my opinions, and then that eventually made me one of the opinion leaders in Taiwan, one of the most celebrated, little bragging here, celebrated political commentator. I became political commentator in Taiwan because I also address on issues in Taiwan. I was welcomed as one of them. But today, some people in Taiwan have this sentiment to think that Taiwan's future is also rely on a good cross-strait relation. So provoking Beijing is not in Taiwan's best interest. So from this perspective, my Chinese dissident status is becoming a little problematic.
I'm going to bring you back to the Uyghur question.
Please do, yeah.
We know that something horrific is happening. It's not a news anymore. Do you have any thoughts on what to be done about the current situation, the Uyghur horror?
I mean, something less maybe far away than bringing democracy to China.
Like in Washington and the Western capitals. Maybe even Taipei.
Yeah. The being 30 years of a dissident, that there's one lesson I can honestly report to all of our listeners here is that pressure works. Outside pressure works. It has always worked. But then it's becoming more and more difficult to apply that pressure because China is becoming much more stronger than, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. But still, there are pressure points. Of this regime that you should press right. And we have been lobbying, of course, to apply the Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act to Chinese officials. I met with some State Department officials today, and then they were talking about which level it should be applied to. And I said, Xi Jinping, that's what I said. And then they were like, oh, no, you're kidding. That's the problem of the Western, you know, diplomats. They feel like everything has to come in a diplomatic way. And from this dissident or student leader's perspective, the things should come in honest way.
Well, you think that applying it to Chen Quanguo would be a good start?
It will be a good start, absolutely. But I just want to, you know, we were talking about the mentality of Washington, D.C. It's hard for them to come around and say, yeah, we made such a big mistake and we feel so embarrassed and we should make right of our mistakes. Come around. We have landed here. You know, come around and realize that you made a bad, bad mistake. This mistake is coming around to get you. We are on the way, and then we got sacrificed in the Chinese dissident Uyghurs, but it's not that far from the rest of the world. So that will be my. I feel like I was a student leader 30 years ago, and come around the lecturing the world to be honest is something is something rather strange, but very much needed.
But Nuri, that's not what you think. I mean, we were having a conversation over lunch today, and you don't think that kind of come around, make, you know, just sort of declare your opposition to engagement, declare, you know, China a pariah state. You don't think that would work to help the Uyghur situation?
You know, my approach has been more of an encouragement than criticizing or making a statement that's not enough, because we're still in the process of building coalition, which is still in the process of educating general public. One of your Twitter followers said that what an ordinary American can do to help, we're in that stage. So the governments around the world tiptoeing around, concerning about economic interest, taking that kind of outdated approach in their dealing with Beijing or Xi Jinping. It's not the same China that we all know. Xi Jinping's China is fundamentally different. Their thinking is different. Their approach is different. Their ambition is different. So we have to look at it differently. So instead of pressuring them, I've been trying to work with them, providing them some solutions. For example, pass the legislation that has been considered. That would be a really good step. And also, if it's too difficult to take on Xi Jinping or China, they should consider special immigration bills to help the Uyghur refugees, students to settle down, like the way that the Swedish government
after
did.
After 89,
yes,
they did that.
There is a precedent that the United States Congress had done this before. And also, you know, they have to speed up the process of going Magnitsky. We have seen it in 2016. Putin was so nervous, so upset that there's a law even in that nature exists. I think it's the same is true with the Chinese leadership. They wanted to continue.
Putin and the oligarchs directly around him are more personally threatened.
Same thing in China. The Xi Jinping wants to send Xi Jinping supporters, wealthy people or influential people, still wanted to send their children to Western capitals for shopping, education, and this kind of legal tools is extremely important. So there's small steps that they can take while considering war, and also the Olympics is also a very good way to start this. I know that 2022 is a way to go. I have two more years to go, but the International Olympic Committee should use its influence, at least pressure the Chinese government to shut down these camps if they still wanted to host the 2022 Olympics. There's several things, you know, that they can do. That going after the companies have been very effective. The Thermo Fisher, for example, was providing DNA sequencers to the Chinese government under the leadership of Rubio and others. The company stopped selling products to Xinjiang authority. But we don't know if it's going through other means to get there. But there have been some positive steps have been taken. So my approach has been a little bit...
I think we're the same.
Yeah.
I think we're the same, really. I don't think we're that different. But I just want to... When you say we are in the stage to educate Americans, but I think the approach should always be value centric instead of interest centric. Yeah.
Well, very good, gentlemen. It's been a real pleasure to talk to both of you. Nuri, always great to have you back, and I look forward to hanging out with you in Taipei.
Let's go there a lot.
Yeah,
welcome.
That'll be a little fun.
Thank you so much, Kaiser. This
Lord Kaiser and Nuri Turkal.
I must say the subchina.com Seneca podcast have been extremely helpful in educating, reaching out to China-related business communities, expats, even Chinese people. At the end of the day, they need to know what's happened to us. So this has been extremely... And also, they started this when the issue was not that popular. Not everybody talks about it, but subchina.com started...
Well, there's still a lot of people who criticize me and think that I don't care somehow, and it's bizarre.
That's an unfair criticism.
Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again soon. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo, that's me, and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Tyson Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, New Voices, and Top for Top, and the Middle Earth Podcast on the culture industry in China. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.